Airplanes can't stall themselves, so why do stall spin accidents keep happening? I'm Paul Plack, and this is AeroNews. Welcome in to the AeroNews special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. Bob's a CFI based in the Buffalo, New York area. He's doing some online training as well now. We'll tell you how to get in touch with those projects at the end of this podcast. But today, I want to talk to Bob about a couple of topics from the April edition of Over the Airwaves. And Bob, thanks for taking some time for our listeners today.
Well, Paul, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
All right. You had an article in the April edition called Airplanes Don't Stall Themselves. And I mean, this is kind of obvious, but tell me why you felt the need to point this out.
Well, when you look at the stall spin accidents that occur, Paul, and they occur about 50 times a year or once a week on average statistically, if you go out in an airplane in actual flight and deliberately try to put it in a stall as we do for training purposes, you'll soon discover that it takes a pilot to actually pull the airplane up above its critical angle of attack. I mean, you absolutely have to deliberately do it in order to create a stall situation. Left to its own, it can't possibly stall. And I'm speaking about an airplane that's loaded within the weight, you know, the required weight and balance specifications for the aircraft. And I'm talking about an airplane that's reasonably trimmed. You can do anything you want to that airplane with power and rudder and ailerons, but you cannot get it to stall unless you pull back on the stick and increase the angle of attack. So why do we have 50 stall spin accidents a year? It's the pilot is doing something to upset the airplane, something very specifically that, as I said before, left to its own, the airplane will not do it. In other words, if in any kind of an upset situation, you could reasonably conclude that if the pilot would simply let loose of the yoke or stick, he has a better chance of survival than trying to do something and doing it incorrectly.
Okay, I would take a couple of minor issues with that. Obviously, if you have an autopilot, an older autopilot set, and you're hands off, you can enter a stall. I mean, 3407, Colgan 3407 proved that.
Yeah, that's correct. But an autopilot is controlling the airplane. Yeah, I'm talking about an airplane that is reasonably trimmed, no autopilot, no forces artificially are being placed on the control surfaces. Just the airplane's doing its own thing. If you just let loose, the airplane cannot stall. Let's take a real life example. Let's take an unusual attitude where the pilot or the flight instructor, for training purposes, puts the airplane, literally rolls it over on its back, creates the most unusual of unusual attitudes, and then lets loose. Just lets loose of all the controls, and we're presuming that there's adequate altitude underneath them. The airplane will not stall. It cannot stall. Because there's by the time it approaches a stall pitch attitude, the nose will by itself drop down. Again, the only caveat is that the airplane is loaded within the load limitations set forth by the manufacturer. And there's a reasonable amount of proper trim. I mean, we can go into a trim stall by trimming the elevator all the way up, and then yeah, but that's an artificial changing of the controls. So, like the physician is taught in early in medical school, the Hippocratic Oath, physician, do no harm. If we had the pilot flight training equivalent to the Hippocratic Oath, pilot, do no harm. Then at least we could prevent stall spin accidents from occurring.
Okay, so the question you ask in your article, why do we unintentionally force our airplanes into a stalled condition?
Why do we do it? It's instinctive where the airplane is going down. For example, he's in a nose-down attitude. In the article I wrote about the RANS accident, or even the JFK Jr. accident that occurred back in the late 1990s, the altitude is unwinding. The vertical speed indicator is showing a nose-down loss of altitude. Airspeed's increasing. Instinctively, we say, well, let's pull back to prevent further loss of altitude. And that pulling back is not the right move. The right move is to do something else. In other words, level the wing. The airplane will come back out of it by itself without going into a stall. But instinctively, and unless we're trained, Otherwise, we're instinctively going to pull back just to stop the loss of altitude, and that's where we have a shortcoming, I believe, in our training system, because we just do not do enough of that in the training environment.
Okay, now, you know, one of the arguments for years against having stall training as part of the PTS, demonstrating full-on stall recovery as part of the PTS, has been that that skill is not useful in most stall accidents that happen in the pattern at unrecoverable altitudes. The thing that strikes me there in that scenario is that, you know, somebody coming around who maybe has misjudged a crosswind and is going to, overshoot the runway sideways on their base to final turn, cranks in more bank, and you can make a stall happen that way pretty easily too. But it seems to keep happening. I guess I don't understand if it's that deadly and that often, why there's not more attention to that.
I don't know. Our friend and colleague Bruce Landsberg over at AOPA's Air Safety Foundation has publicly stated more than once that stalls that occur in the traffic pattern are essentially non-recoverable. I would agree. There's not enough altitude. And he would say, then why practice something that's not recoverable when most of them occur in the traffic pattern? And my thinking on the subject is, if we practice them full stalls and spins at a safe altitude, our human senses, our inner ear, our body will begin to feel long before a stall occurs what we're approaching a stall type event in the airplane, and we would be much more sensitized to it. It's like a child on the stove. If a child has never burned his finger on the stove, he may not be quite so sensitive about the way he cooks. And I'm not suggesting we burn children's fingers on the stove. Of course not. But through life, we begin to experience that kind of a sensation inadvertently. I'm saying we could do the same thing to our student pilots, by taking them up at a safe altitude, 3,000, 4,000 feet above the ground, and let them physically feel what a stall feels like. Let them feel what an impending spin feels like. Let them actually see how fast it can develop. Let me just tell you a very quick story. I've done a lot of training in a very docile Cessna 172 and Piper Archers and things like that. When they go into a stall, it's about as gentle as riding on grandma's rocking chair. I took some training in an extra 300 a number of years ago, and the instructor said, first thing we're going to do, Bob, is let's pull it into a stall. Now, an extra 300 is a fully aerobatic airplane, symmetrical wings. Pulled it up into a stall, and I want to tell you, the bottom fell out of that airplane, literally fell out of the bottom of the airplane. I was an experienced flight instructor. I let loose of the stick. I yelled to the instructor pilot sitting behind me. I said, take it. I had no idea an airplane would stall with such sudden loss of flight. And now, having gone through that kind of training, I can truly appreciate the dangers of a stall and how fast they can occur. Now we can do the same thing in a Cessna 172 or in a training aircraft by taking up in through what we call a whip stall, pulling it up aggressively so we get a very solid stall break, not just an incipient stall where we get a little bit of flutter on the controls and the stall horn. I mean where it literally stops flying and comes down for a little while in a falling leaf kind of thing where you just feel a sudden sense of unpleasantness and then affect a proper recovery and fine. Now, if that should happen at the traffic pattern, sure, Bruce is right. It's not recoverable. But I maintain that it would not even come close to happening in a traffic pattern if every pilot was trained at a safe altitude. They would see, for example, what an accelerated stall can do when an airplane's banked over 45 degrees. I've gone out on flight reviews where an individual will take me, and I'll have them do a deliberate tight pattern and a close-in approach, and they'll crank that airplane over 55 degrees at 60 knots. And immediately I'm on the controls leveling the wings and saying, what are you doing? He says, well, Bob, I'm giving you a tight approach just like you request. And then we get on the ground, we sit down, and we recompute the stall speed of that very aircraft in a 60 or 70-degree bank. And his eyes bug wide open. I said, do you realize how close we came to dying out there with that tight approach? Well, no, I didn't know it was going to do that. And they don't. They have no clue. And this explains the 50 fatal stall spins we have a year in the United States. And I don't mean we have to go out and give full stall spin training. You know, not all aircraft, in fact, quite a few airplanes are not certified for spin training. But by golly, we can go out and do accelerated stalls. We can do incipient stalls. We can even take an incipient stall immediately into a spiral, which is perfectly legal, and give very much the same sensation to that trainee pilot that a full stall spin would have. Now, the other problem, as we look at it, and I think Bruce might be implying this, although he hasn't said it, perhaps our industry does not have enough confidence in the skill level of our cadre of flight instructors. Because right now we've got at least three full generations of flight instructors that perhaps themselves have never been trained like this, and now we're going to go ahead and ask them to conduct this kind of training. That could be very damaging as well. So now we have a double problem. We have a need for a much more set of aggressive training scenarios, but we have an industry filled with flight instructors who themselves are not skilled enough to do it. So how do we fix that problem? Well, that takes regulatory change. That takes... We can't do anything about the old pilots, perhaps, the older instructors, but we certainly could do something about new instructors coming back into the system.
Well, and in the meantime, it's not in the practical test standards, and it's probably not coming back anytime soon, but there are places you can go. You can call guys like Rich Stoll or, go to Kissimmee like you did, or there are places you can go to get some of that training, and the cost of it won't seem like so much if it saves your life.
Paul, let me just conclude by saying you are right on. Any flight instructor who's listening to this podcast now, if they truly consider themselves to be a flight training professional, they ought to go avail themselves to at least 3 days of professional-level aerobatic training. That will make them a much, much better flight instructor.
All right. Well, listen, I don't want to run out of time before I get to another topic here. And you come down on AOPA fairly often, and you issued them some kudos in the April edition. I want to talk about that in a moment. My guest is Bob Miller. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Piperjet.
Pipermatch.
Global expansion.
Meridian, Mirage, Matrix, and more.
With so much happening at Piper, how can I possibly keep up?
Get informed. Get involved at facebook.com/Piper Aircraft.
Deck, ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking. Looks like our flight time to Hawaii will be about 5 hours and 20 minutes, give or take. We're trying to save a little gas by keeping the fuel load pretty light today. So, just a heads up not to panic if you hear the engines shut down a little later in the flight, since we might have to glide that last little bit in the Honolulu. Not to worry, though, we almost always make it, so sit back, relax.
All right, Bob, that is a very... kind of darkly funny thing for pilots to hear, but AOPA has prepared that little promotional 30-second spot for pilots in order to get a point across, and you commended them for that.
I did, Paul, and not only that part of it, but their concluding message, which I found even more profound, said, and I'm quoting, "We general aviation pilots suffer 3 to 4 crashes a week due to fuel mismanagement issues," unquote. That statement is one of the few statements I've seen from AOPA where they actually indict us very, very specifically on our misdeeds by giving us that data point that reminds us that 3 to 4 crashes a week occur due to fuel mismanagement. And for that, I think this was a breath of fresh air. No longer are they telling us that we're good and getting better, but they're telling us, hey, we're not as good as many of us think we are. I used to have conversations at meetings with Phil Boyer, and Phil did great things for general aviation. I respect him immensely, but he used to say, you know, regarding getting people out to these safety seminars, he'd say, you know, Bob, we can lead a horse to water, but we can't make him drink. And my retort was always, Phil, they're not going to drink if they don't think they're thirsty. If we continue to tell pilots that they're good and getting better and this is a safe industry and everything is cool out there, they're not going to see any reason to come out for training. And this particular piece where they remind us 3 to 4 crashes a week due to fuel mismanagement, that caught my attention. And if it caught my attention, I'm sure it caught many other pilots who may have seen that piece for the first time. I think that was a great bit of educational promotion. And yes, hats off to AOPA for doing that.
Well, we'll put a link along with this podcast in the data field that allows people to find that on the AOP website. And it really does kind of make you think. And obviously, we've talked about the big two in this Aerocast because, you know, if we could somehow eliminate stall spin accidents and fuel mismanagement accidents, general aviation would be a whole lot safer.
And add one more to that, continued VFR flight into IMC conditions, and there's a way to do that too, Paul, and that is to do away with this notion of simulated instrument training. If you can find the clouds, get in the clouds with your students and let them see that we don't go from blue sky to gray skies instantly like flipping on a view-limiting device. It's insidious. It's seductive, and before we know it, we're buried, and we don't even know what happened. And unfortunately, at that point, an untrained pilot has about 30 seconds to live. That's another message that I would hope that AOPA would come out with and say, hey, listen, we have far too many of these kinds of accidents as well, and there's something that can be done about that.
All right, Bob. Well, as always, we appreciate your viewpoint and your poking us in the ribs, and we'll talk to you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
You can subscribe to Bob Miller's free monthly email newsletter and find a link to more info about his flight school at overtheairwaves.com. The May edition of the newsletter was published just yesterday, and you'll receive it shortly after you register. You've been listening to the special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.